like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest today is Diane Delano, founder of the Wild Horse Rescue Center, which, located in Webster, Florida, rescues, rehabilitates, and finds new homes for wild horses. The center receives Mustangs who have been taken from the wild and sometimes ended up in neglectful or abusive situations. Delano maintains a longstanding relationship with the Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, and in 1998, she was one of 20 people selected by the BLM to be a compliance officer. Beyond specializing in rescuing and rehabilitating wild horses, another trait that distinguishes Wild Horse Rescue Center is the International Volunteer Program launched by Delano in 2012, which has since seen volunteers visiting the Webster facility from France, Italy, Britain, among many other countries. As you might imagine, though, various COVID-associated restrictions and protocols have forced a suspension for the moment of that program. Delano has won recognition awards for her work, a passion and sense of achievement possibly preordained when she began riding horses at age 3. We'll find out more about her and the Wild Horse Rescue Center in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Later in today's program, I'll speak briefly with A.J. Nakia, founder of Compassion Kind, which specializes in rescuing animals in regions pummeled by major hurricanes and other disasters, such as Hurricane Ida. So a member of Compassion Kind deployed to Louisiana, and we'll hear what they need to do to get support and help in their rescue mission down there, beyond the obvious monetary donations, but if there's certain kind of supplies or others that some of us could help send down there or get to them in some way, that'll be one of the things we'll talk about. Well, so we'll find out more when I speak with Agent Nakia in just a few moments later on in today's show, in fact. Right now, though, let's discuss rescuing wild horses and related topics with Diane Delano, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Diane Delano on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Duncan. Thank you so much for giving us time to talk about our Wild Horse Rescue Center on your wonderful show.
Well, thank you, and thanks for joining us this morning. So, in fact, it would be hard to imagine someone whose childhood, as I've kind of noted there in the introduction, more directly foreshadowed what their life's work would become. So you started riding horses at age 3. So as far back as you can go, tell me one or two of your very, very earliest memories of horses.
Well, I was fortunate to have my parents had horses for us kids back in the 60s.
Yeah.
And I loved being with the horses. Most of the photographs you have of me as a child that my parents have is either with the dogs, with the horses, with a woodchuck. I was in a cowboy hat. I just always have loved animals. And I can remember we had 4 horses. We had a pony, Shetland, which was mine, and then another pony, and then ex-military horse, a cavalry horse that we ended up with. And then we ended up with this stallion. And my mother let me sit up on the stallion to take pictures. And my father was so upset. He was like, that was a stallion. And you know what I felt as a child when I look back at those pictures? I look so at home and comfortable on horses. You could just see the way I'm sitting on them, even as a child.
Well, it sounds like kind of the ultimate blending of inherent sort of passion and great opportunity. I mean, sometimes people feel like, hey, I'd love to get to know a horse or spend some time with a horse, but they don't have the kind of access you have. Or sometimes they do have access, but sometimes they're just not necessarily as passionate as it sounds like you were from toddlerhood.
Well, I can tell you right now, we have wonderful volunteers here from the villages. And we have a lovely lady, Deborah, that volunteers 3 days a week. And Deborah's story is exactly what you're saying. All of her life, she wanted to have a horse. She wanted to grow up with him from a childhood. She had some red boots that she wore as a child. And here, later in life, she came down to volunteer for us last year when COVID hit. Our international program, within 3 weeks, was dissolved. We had 11 people here, and they all had to leave. And some of those people had just arrived to stay for 3 months. So in March, by the end of March, we no longer had an international program, which I still currently do not. So we were fortunate to run just a little paragraph. I couldn't even believe the calls I got from the villages. A paragraph went in their Daily Sun, and I started having people call in, and they wanted to know if they could come help. And Deborah and I have another gentleman, George, are two of my founding village people. We get the village people without the music and without the costume.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's one way to do it for sure. So for people who may be listening, depending on where they are, because people listen to this show online from all kinds of spaces and states and whatever. So maybe tell a little bit more about the villages, because I think that really did lead to what turned out to have been a really great solution for kind of a major problem when the International Volunteer Program did have to be suspended.
Absolutely. We moved 2 years ago this September over here from Brevard County, from MIMS to Webster. And when I moved into Webster, it's Sumter County. Well, just north of me, about 30 minutes north of me, is an area called Brownwood, which is a Western-type town. And I always fell in love with that because it has bronze statues, life-size of cracker horses, cracker cows, dogs, and cowboys. So the Villages is a retirement community that was developed for safe area for retired people, 55, I guess, and up. Mm-hmm. And it has golf courses, it has restaurants, and it has these little town squares. You have Brownwood, Spanish, what's the other one? The other one is a nautical one, the lake one. They're building a new one. It's absolutely beautiful. It looks like you just went to Walt Disney World with the landscape. I mean, magnificent landscape on their roads, in their neighborhood. Their towns are set up. So a lot of retired people are up in that area. And the new retiree people are like, look, we're our new 20s. Because they like to get out and dance. They like to get out and golf. Or
be active.
Events.
Yeah.
Yep. So they are very, very active people. So we have people come from the villages anywhere from 50 years to 80. And when our 80-year-old volunteers were coming here, like Harvey, for example, was a gentleman, he did water. So that's all he had to do was just fill up water buckets. So he didn't have to lift wheelbarrows. He didn't have to do physical stuff. And that's something that if anybody can help us, we surely can have an area that you can help in. Some people like the physical work. Some people don't mind doing the wheelbarrow. Some people love spending the time just grooming and being around the horse.
But the key thing about the upshot here is that there's basically this battalion of folks from the villages that are, although it's, as you know, a wide range of sort of retirees, but that's kind of who really took over and kind of helped solve the problem, as it turned out, when you lost all the volunteers that were coming through the International Volunteer Program. Do I have that right?
You have that absolutely right, because as long as I've been a rescue, we've always had a few local volunteers help out, but I'll tell you, I've never had the amount of wonderful people that I have here in the villages. And I have to say that probably part of it is because they are retired, a lot of them,
mm-hmm.
and they do have that extra time. And our chores are from 9 a.m. to noon. So, and that's every day, you know, Monday through Sunday. We do have a few other younger people that come from other areas, whether it's from Tampa. We actually have a husband and wife come all the way over from Melbourne one day a week, and that's
wow.
an hour and a half away.
Yeah.
We have a dear friend, Henry Meeker, which lives in the Green Swamp. He's who got me on the radio station with you. So we're kind of a mixed match of people from all over come here with the same common thing, to help and give to these animals.
What I want to do, Diane, if we could, because we sort of jumped way ahead of, in some ways, of the basic story that I was going to hope to get from you. So I think what we might do now is go back and kind of fill in that story and then bring us right up to the Wild Horse
okay.
Rescue Center, because now we have a sense of a lot of the volunteer folks that are helping out there, but we don't have much of a sense of the center itself or how it came to be or some other things. So let's go back to when you were in that fortunate position of being a young kid with horses kind of immediately accessible. If I'm not mistaken, this was in upstate New York?
Yes, it was. We lived up in the Catskills, And so I also had the fun as a child to play outside a lot and find critters all the time. Mm-hmm. I remember my father finding a baby woodchuck, and he brought it home to me, and I was able to take care of it, and we set it free. And every year, they only live a few years. So for 2 years, I could call Peanuts, was his name, and he'd come from wherever or from hibernation and come and sit on my lap, and I would feed him food. So I always had this drawing to animals, to nature.
Yeah.
I mean, we helped pigeons. When we moved to Florida, we helped a couple of seagulls. And so I always had, you know, this want to be with animals. My parents, when we moved to Florida, I was 9, and I didn't have a horse for a few years, but I soon had friends that had horses. And by my 13th birthday, my father bought me my very own horse. And, you know, you look at today, people are, you know, safety is so important. Back in 1975, my father bought me a $100 horse that was 2 years old, was tame, of course, but she wasn't saddle trained. And there you go, kid, there's your horse. And so I learned to saddle train her. I had the fortune of being at a boarding barn with lots of other kids. So we just grew up learning all sorts of stuff by trial and error, a lot of it. But when you're at that age, you're pretty brave and you're pretty willing to do stuff that at this age, I don't do.
Yeah, well, that's no doubt. But again, I think a key thing that we already established when you were even younger and first getting on a horse at 3 is that if your family was steeped in horses and just that world and knew about them as they were, obviously, so then when your father did get you that horse, I mean, he knew enough, at least, clearly, to get a horse that was tame. Yeah, maybe it wasn't saddle trained, but that you could safely ride even as a 13-year-old. So again, it was an ongoing reflection of being very familiar with that world from the get-go.
And I had that horse for 34 years.
Oh, my goodness.
She was 36 years old when I had to put her down. I had her through me growing up as a child. I had her through my children growing up to my grandchild riding her, through changes of jobs, marriages, divorces, everything in my life that you had to deal with as life. I always kept my horse because my horse was like my peace place. Like I could go be with my horse and just enjoy the time with her.
Yeah. What was the horse's name?
Raindrop.
Raindrop?
Yep, because she looked like that. She was an Appaloosa, so she had spots all over her. She looked like she had rain had dropped all over her.
Yeah. Well, talk about a through line, like you say. I mean, boy, that really does cover a lot of life experiences and triumphs and losses and all kinds of things. So that's really quite remarkable.
And that's another thing about adopting these horses out, that you have to realize this animal can live, on the average, 25 to 35 years old. I think the oldest documented horse is 56. So, you know, these animals can live a long time. So when you get one, are you in it for the long haul of, you know, making sure that horse is provided for and taken care of?
And that's an important criteria that you try to establish when you get to the point with a certain horse that someone is interested in adopting it.
I do. We really try to stress that, that this isn't just a short-term thing, because horses are very much like humans. They have emotions and feelings. And just like people, you know, if you're shuffled around a lot, you might not feel a sense of belonging. And if horses go, just like dogs, go from home to home to home, sometimes they can pick up some pretty bad habits or have some issues there. Being a rescue, I see a lot of extreme issues because we are open to letting everything and anything come in. We have a little museum at our center. It's an education center museum. And all this is just my lifetime of work that I have collected and did. We have a picture board of many horses that are just so sad to see. But the thing that is about them, almost every one of those horses made it. And you see a soullessness in their eyes in the photos that I have. But when you give them back their health, their emotional health and love, they blossom. They really do. They have life back into their soul.
Hmm. Yeah. And let me let folks know who might just be tuning in or have just tuned in a moment ago or two. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just, in fact, tune in, my guest is Diane Delano, founder of the Wild Horse Rescue Center, a facility in Webster, Florida, that rescues, rehabilitates, and finds new homes for wild horses. If you'd like to ask Diane a question about wild horses or if you'd like to offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663. Email dj at wmnf.org or text 813-433-0885. So when you first got Raindrop, I mean, you'd already obviously been around horses, had experience with horses, but was there something about that experience that maybe changed you that you can look back all these years now and say, wow, that was kind of a pivotal moment in my life?
Well, I actually have had several of those pivotal moments. In 1975, when my father gave me Raindrops for my 13th birthday, I had already been going to that stable for about 2 years because I had met girls at school. And so I was, my father knew all these girls. They had become great friends of mine. So 1975, when I got my horse, I seen my very first Mustang came into the boarding barn. And the 1971, President Nixon signed the bill to save the wild horse. And 1973, they started being adopted for $125. Well, I'm all the way over in Florida, and that there wasn't many Mustangs at that point, and that was the first Mustang I'd ever seen. And it was tame. It was absolutely beautiful. The girl was only there for a very short time. She was moving through. But I stayed in love with that fantasy of getting a wild horse. So as my children grew, as I got a little older, I had my daughter at 18. So I can remember my daughter's weekly reader in elementary school. And there was an article about Dayton Hyde saving 100 wild horses from, they were older, unadoptable, unwanted Mustangs that were from a roundup. And I was like, how amazing he made a place for these horses to be. So I kept following about Mustangs. I have a piece of pottery from seventh grade with Mustangs, and I still have that pottery, of them running around like in the desert. So even in 1975, I felt that I needed to help the Mustang.
Yeah. And, sorry to interrupt, but I was
never
just
stopped.
Yeah, well, clearly, we'll get more into that story momentarily. But why do you think, obviously, we established you were a horse person from childhood, very young age, but why do you think that seeing that first wild horse spoke to you in such a way that it did when you were still quite young yourself?
Maybe because, like I said, I had had wild animals that I was able to tame up. And the idea of taking this untouched horse that is more like a deer, they're afraid of people, they're not a predator, they're a prey on animals. So this animal that's really afraid of you touching it, to learn to trust you, to allow you to touch and work with it. I still to this day almost get teary-eyed working with some really difficult horses that once you start getting that touch and they start trusting you. I'm working with a mare right now, and she's now finally reaching to touch my hand when I go to touch her. She's still got a ways to go, but it's a very, very rewarding feeling inside. Like, you're helping this animal learn that humans are okay. Like, I'm okay with you. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to feed you and provide for you. The wild horses are different in the sense of that they actually were born out in the wild. They actually had a family. Where a lot of horses today are bred and born in captivity, and people wean the baby off and have a mare and have a baby, and they take the baby, you know, and wean it. Out in the wild, the whole family raises them, the stallion, the mare, its aunt, and they raise each other. And they're actually wild horses that have grown up in the wild are a little bit more respectful, and actually I enjoy working with them because they understand body language really well, and they look at everything that you're doing. So they're very intent on their surroundings. On another note, I was on the phone with a deputy down in Miami, and they're looking at maybe getting a Mustang because they've heard a lot of good stuff about Mustangs. And they are very sure-footed horses. They also are very smart. They analyze stuff.
Yeah, well, speaking of analyzing, let's back up if we could for a sec. Tell me more about when you say they're great at reading body language. Give me some more specifics about that, because that seems really interesting.
Well, they are watching everything you do. And a horse is cut up into, like, you've got the head area, then you've got the head and the neck, and then you've got the shoulders to the middle of the body, and then the hips to the back of the body. So depending on where my body is, I could be 30 feet away from it. I could be even further than that. Where I put my position of my body, they are already figuring where they need to be. So a lot of horses are not in tune as much with that. With a Mustang, if you step, say I'm working a wild horse and I want him to not go forward, and all I have to do is lean my weight to my left, and I shut that door for him to feel like he can go forward. If I step back, he will turn and pivot and come towards you. If I step towards him, I can send him the other way. So they become so in tune with what you're doing.
Yeah.
I knew a gentleman that called it dancing with horses. And when I went to the Wild Horse Workshop, he had that logo, Dancing with Horses. And it really is. Your first working with these Mustangs can be like dancing with horses because they're watching every movement that you do.
Yeah, and they sound like they're just have kind of a real gift for responding as those movements happen on the human's end, responding in kind pretty deftly.
And sadly, being the rescue end, that's where I get a lot of horses overstimulated. Like, the people think, a lot of people think that you can just manhandle them. You can just, you know, rope them and grab them up and do stuff to them, and they just take it. And that is really sad because, just like humans, some humans will just take it and it'll sink in and you'll become unsure and afraid of everything. And some humans will become aggressive and become bullies or dominating to not be taken like that. So your Mustang is very similar to that. If you are too hard on them, you can really make them sink within themselves to not want to try. If you are too hard on them but a scaredy pants, if you're a bully and you're really afraid but you act hard, you surely can make an aggressive Mustang. I've had a lot of aggressive horses come in from fear aggressive. So the Mustang is evaluating you at everything you're doing as well.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about, since these Mustangs end up at your facility, tell us a little bit more about the Wild Horse Rescue Center, when you first launched it and what prompted it, because it sounds like there was a facility that was prior to that that you referred to, I think, in MIMS. But so give us kind of a little bit of the story of how that came to be and kind of what it's like now.
So I got my first Mustang when I was about 29 years old, and I just fell in love with it. I was actually pregnant. I was 5 months pregnant with my third child, and I adopted this two-year-old wild colt. You know, I did all the training myself. So if you're thinking that muscle for muscle has to be there, no, it doesn't. And by I was in the newspaper in 93 when that article was, and that Mustang, I had him for 2 weeks at that time, was running around the round pen with this pregnant lady. Now I was 6 months pregnant, doing an article for the newspaper. So I did all the training. When I was up into my 8th month, I'm out taking him for walks. I had that particular horse. I lost him in 2019. He was 32 years old, and I had him for 30 years.
Wow.
And that was my Rio. And so when you look at working with these horses, it makes you a really good horse person. It really does. Because when you start, if you have compassion, and that's another thing where my logo came up with, a heart in the hand means I touch the horse with my heart in the hand. That's why that logo is there. That's why I had that drawn up for the logo. So in the 90s, when I had my Mustangs as personal horses, I started running into a lot of people that were having issues with their horses. And I was just in love with the Mustang as a breed. I started adopting. I went to all the adoptions. I started volunteering for the Bureau of Land Management. I would come and set up the table. I'd bring my tame Mustang to the event to talk to people.